Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco to move back into, for a minute, some C.S. Lewis content. It's working out well for us. I think there's a lot of new listeners to the show who were brought in by that content, and we appreciate being able to hit a topic that people are interested in.
They're going to be really surprised when we get back into Lutheran theology.
And they're going to be really surprised when we get back into Lutheran theology. Yeah, that's true. But today we're going to start a three-part series on a book by Lewis called The Abolition of Man. It's a short book, and it was originally a lecture or a series of lectures given. Yeah,
three lectures at University of Durham in 1943.
Which is essentially a response to a book on English education, and then Lewis's own ideas and values on education, the purpose, the place, what we're actually trying to accomplish in educating children, and sort of where that leaves society. And I think the way I want to approach this is through the, so that we can get a particular spin on it and maybe a particularly Lutheran spin on it, is I want to approach it through a vocational angle, and that might help us transition into a different series that we've talked about doing for a while, which is actually doing an explicit series on vocation. And I've thought about this recently as I was asked to suggest our best episodes on vocation, and I found a very early one from the first year of the Thinking Fellows. And then
In the garage days.
Nice. And I could barely listen to it. So really kudos to everybody who enjoyed the show even back then. And then I listened to one from the second year of the Thinking Fellows, and I had an even harder time listening to that, mostly because I talked more than that first year. And boy, I wanted to tell myself to shut it. So did we. Yeah.
So did we.
So kudos to the people who stuck with us through year two of the Thinking Fellows. But we haven't done vocation explicitly in a while. What I found when I searched through our catalog was that especially when we did vocation, we had some episodes on vocations of particular people, mostly church work though, mostly preaching and things like that. We had pastors on, which is certainly important, and I'm glad we've covered it. But I think it would be great to do a broad, top-level vocational set of episodes again that'd be available to people. And I think The Abolition of Man might be able to help kick that off. Because as I noticed here, and you're addressing a problem like this, Lewis is doing it from a more universal position, concerns for the society at large. But I think when we talk about education, we might be able to ask the question and maybe start this episode with the question and then explain the context and the content of the book a little further, is if education really does take a slide, if there's something wrong or harmful going on, who are the people that are harmed? And I think what is to do about the harm of those particular people? And that might help us bring it more from focusing on the downfalls of education as this big universal category, and maybe look at the education of our children or our neighborhoods or ourselves even, and what that means for the way we view and live in the world.
So you don't want us to just complain?
No, I don't want you to. You can do some complaining.
Okay.
I mean, this one may also be one of those episodes where it's going to be interesting how much we temper ourselves, because all three of us have very strong opinions on education, I think. And Adam still works for an educational institution. 15, you still occasionally teach adjunct for an educational institution.
That's what my bio says.
I don't, so I can have whatever opinions I want. But I have children who are entering school age, and there is no more disagreeable topic between parents than decisions you make regarding your kid's education. Yeah. If you want to make other parents feel suspicious of you, or if you want to dislike other parents, that your kids hang out
or
with their
kids.
Or feel
better than them.
Or feel better than them or feel superior. Have opinions about the way your children are being educated.
Or their children are being educated.
Or the way their children are being educated.
It really is divisive. It's amazing. Especially if you hang around or you work among educators and they find that you homeschool. Or, you know, I know certain pastors who, I've known pastors over the years who have had schools connected to the church they pastor over, and they've decided to homeschool their kids instead of send them to that school, which is very interesting. It must be very uncomfortable for them.
Yeah, that would be a tough
call. Lots of reasons for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be uncomfortable. And I've run into this homeschooling my kids. My mother-in-law is a public school teacher, and my one of my sister-in-laws teaches music at a Lutheran school and stuff. And when you say you're going to homeschool, even without that intention being that, they feel like their vocation is being assailed or critiqued, even if you haven't given a reason for the homeschooling yet, that you're sort of invalidating the work they do by saying my kids aren't going to have part in something like that.
Yeah. And then the next comment or question out of their mouth is going to be, well, how are your kids going to be socialized? Mm-hmm. I should not go down that rabbit hole.
Well, it does get to be an annoying question just because it's so, it's just the question, right? As if it's, a huge issue in the long run. I've admittedly met some homeschool kids that when they were 10, you might say were a little more socially awkward than some other kids. But then I've met most 10-year-olds these days, and I think they're more socially awkward than I remember being, or I remember my kids being, but that could just be sort of selective memory on my part.
Well, I would,
maybe 10-year-olds are just socially awkward, you know, and it's an easy trope to try to justify. And usually the funny thing is, I think with homeschool kids is that awkwardness usually comes from being quite smart and knowing, you know, quite a few things that aren't very common for children to know.
They're interested in different conversations. They're much more comfortable typically in conversations with adults. But at the same time, have you met, I'm not picking on public schools here. I have kids that go to public schools. I find it socially awkward when a kid who goes to a public school introduces themselves with their name and then adds in what pronouns they prefer.
I haven't run into that.
I don't want my kids socialized into that. You know, I'd rather them maybe pick their nose in the corner while talking about Homer's Iliad than think that there's some sort of weird difference between sex and gender.
That's a good lead-in, because I think...
thank you.
Yeah, that was good.
It really was.
Yeah. Oh. how should we start, Caleb? I mean, the book, The Abolition of Man, is broken down into essentially what were three lectures, three different names, chapters here in the book.
Yeah, from 1943. And bigger context in the background. One of my colleagues, by the way, told me I don't talk much on this show, so I'm going to try to...
That's good.
Whiskey or tequila or whatever, talk more. But 1943, Lewis is right in the midst of World War II. Lewis is invited over to the University of Durham to give a series of lectures, the Riddell lectures, which always have to do with morality, religion in the public sphere, or something along those lines.
Mine says here it was the 15th series in the Riddell lectures that he gave.
And I think it's important to set, I don't know if you guys want to, but we should anyway, talk about the intellectual backdrop, because when he gets into what he calls the Green Book, that comes from a particular intellectual milieu that you won't get unless you, or you won't understand the Green Book and
love
the critique.
Set up the premise, because I think this was the fourth or the fifth time that I had read this. I read it once late high school, and my dad was constantly putting stacks of books in the must-read pile, which is great. But I read it once in high school. I'm sure I thought it was great in that it gave me a superiority complex, because the type of education that we were partaking in at that point in my life was nothing like what Lewis was critiquing. So that was great. I read it once again in college, just sort of on my own. Then as a part of an independent study with Steve Mueller on C.S. Lewis. Then I bought a first edition of it in New York on like my first trip to New York City. I was at the Strand, right, bookstore?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Nice
and
bookstore.
I went upstairs to the rare books room, and there was a first edition Abolition of Man. So I grabbed that, and it wasn't actually super expensive. So I grabbed that and reread it because I had it. I was like, oh, I should probably read this. And then I read it again this week. And the beginning is very funny because it's something that now I think we've all experienced, which is you get sent a free book from a publisher and they yeah. want you to say something positive about this book. They know that you're in the field and they want you to praise them. If you're us today, or if you're the Thinking Fellows, you would have been mailed this book with a request to come on the podcast.
Yeah.
And then,
or to talk about it on the podcast.
Right. And that's like the beginning context is he sent a book on English education, because he's an expert in the field. And, unfortunately his comments are not going to be,
although positive. He owes them good words.
Yes, he owes them good words.
So what's the background of the Green Book there, Adam, the Melu?
Well, the Green Book is, he doesn't use the title of the actual book because he at least feigns or pretends that he doesn't really want to do the authors harm because they're not, how does he put it? You know, they weren't writing some sort of scholarly tome. They're writing a book for the upper form school. So that's like our equivalent to junior and senior high. Here. But the Green Book, the original or the title of the actual book is The Control of Language, A Critical right. Approach to Reading and Writing by a man named Alex King and Martin Ketley, who I think were either Cambridge or Oxford students who did their degrees. And I believe they had moved to Australia to teach or something like that. But those two authors come from a intellectual background that I think we've talked about positivism on this show before. But positivism in Oxford and what was sometimes called subjectivism in Cambridge, that, you know, there's lots to be said about it, but in Oxford, where Lewis is writing from, it's especially associated with the man A.J. Ayer mm-hmm. and his book Language, Truth, and Logic. And then there was another, I can't remember the exact name of the guy in Cambridge, but basically they said that when we use language, when we put together a sentence or an assertion about the world, the truthfulness of those assertions is determined by whether that assertion corresponds to the actual world. But they went a step further. They said anything in that assertion about the world that's a qualifier, like what we call an adjective or an adverb, like if you call a waterfall anything sublime. Other than a waterfall, like you call it a sublime waterfall, those sort of qualifiers, and by extension, you could say if you call something good or right. evil or something like that, those qualifiers, those sort of judgments on things, natural, material things, are simply an expression of the person making the statement, an expression of their opinion or their emotional state or something like that. And
also they're trying to add meaning to those, whereas the positivists originally are going to categorize those as sort of meaningless. Yep. They're going to mm-hmm. say it doesn't, if you call something beautiful, it doesn't teach me anything about beauty. It's not an objective definition. It's not creative word. It doesn't make the waterfall beautiful. Mm-hmm. So it's meaningless. Whereas they're now trying to kind of get away from the category of meaningless and find meaning to what the positivists originally sort of, you know, laid out to the realm of descriptive, purely descriptive language, which may or may not actually have to have a correlation to any reality. Mm-hmm. And now they're saying the reality as you make it or as you envision it is meaningful, whether or not it corresponds to anything outside of yourself. Right? Or no?
Who's the they in your sentence?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's where I got lost.
The individual making the claim. So if I say something's beautiful, that doesn't have to correlate to any definition of beauty outside of myself.
So I think
correct. That's the subjectivism.
Yes. Yeah.
That's it.
And that's what the authors Cambridge. Of the Green Book are adding to logical positivism, which isn't originally yes. there in Ayer or Wittgenstein or any of the other analytic authors.
I think the assumption right. when you say something is meaningless, though, that means that it's actually meaningless, and that's not how they would have used that.
It's not derogatory.
It can be very meaningful to the individual. It's just meaningless in the sense that it can't be externally proven to be a true or a false statement. Yeah.
It's not objective. It's a pure subjective claim.
It's an expression of an emotion that you're having, really, in the moment, and that emotion can be meaningful to you, but it's just. It's one, not necessarily meaningful to me, right? If I look at a waterfall, I'm not necessarily feeling the same thing you're feeling.
I don't know. Maybe you and I stumble across a waterfall and we both sort of say, wow. I say, Scott, look at that waterfall. And you say, sublime. And we say, oh my gosh, we're thinking the same things.
Yeah.
Like going we're thinking.
Like going to the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
No, I think that's. I the two phrases that are often used for that when we sort of talk about analytic sort of categories are nonsensical and meaningless, and they both kind of have a negative connotation to them that I don't think is implied in just the use of the terms and an attempt to try to express that those are subjective statements.
Yeah, I mean, if you tell somebody that what they say is meaningless, they're gonna be pretty upset with you.
Yeah, I've done it. Yeah. It doesn't work very well tactically.
Scott, wouldn't the positivist, wouldn't a guy like Ayer, and it's been probably 20 years since I read Language, Truth, and Logic, and I don't plan on reading it again, but wouldn't he say something like, it's technically meaningless?
Yes.
Meaning, not that he's like trying to critique you, he's saying that there just is no objective value to those.
Yeah, he's literally writing like a technical manual in a sense for the use of language. And so to say it's technically meaningless is, you know, that's a correct way of putting that for him. It's just a matter of saying, listen, I can't ascribe any outward meaning to that is
universal.
That is universal or taken out of your individual experience in the moment. From the expression.
And Scott, Caleb, you mentioned the name Wittgenstein, who's a little earlier than he's active in Cambridge, in the 19-teens and 20s. Mm-hmm. In his famous work, which is part of this larger milieu, intellectual milieu, the Tractatus, he says something like, towards the end, that claims of ethics have no meaning. There can be no meaning unless it comes from outside. What Lewis is detecting the philosophy behind the Green Book is this movement that we call it positivism or subjectivism, whatever you want to call it. But behind that is even something more problematic, if you will, and that is crass materialism, a view that says, as Wittgenstein says it in the first sentence of the Tractatus, the world is all that is the case. Mm-hmm. There is nothing above, beyond, before, or anything like that. And so Lewis starts off Abolition of Man, the first chapter. It's called, I don't have it in front of me, it's called Men Without Chests, right? That's the one he calls Men Without Chests?
Yes.
By talking about how he received this Green Book and he's been asked to review it, and he doesn't want to be too harsh on it, but he is going to be harsh because he like you said earlier, Caleb, he knows what the effects of this will be on the schoolboy.
He's predicting in a lot of ways sort of where this landed. Now in the U.S., I'd say it took many more years than I think he would have thought for it to sort of work itself out. But in Europe, his predictive model, showed pretty true by the, 50s and 60s.
And the tail end of that prediction is that by ascribing a special universal type of meaning to emotional or descriptive claims, that those will become sort of the only truth claims, that real truth claims will sort of lay waste to the way people feel about them.
Well, I think and correct me if I'm wrong, but the precise criticism of the Green Book is that it disallows for one seemingly subjective statement to be superior to another.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep.
And that's the strict criticism of it. I mean, he goes on, you know, on and on and on and on for it, but and he argues the opposite of that there is something that, in my opinion, he unfortunately calls the Tao. He calls
the Tao.
Well,
there's reasons for that.
No, there are, but I just think there's been some damage done by that.
Yeah. Let me jump in just for a second before we get past that. It's like 4 or 5 pages into the first chapter where he says something in effect. He goes, I wouldn't be so critical of the authors of the Green Book, except they use the word solely or only. That is, right. You know, like Lewis knows full well, some qualifiers, adjectives are subjective, purely subjective. He knows full well there are some sort of moral codes or systems and cultural norms that are purely subjective or constructed over the course of centuries. But when the authors of the Green Book take the position that all qualifiers, all morality and so on and so forth, or by extension all morality is just sort of a construct or relative and so on, that's his issue, like you said.
Yeah. I also think it's worth noting, and you could do this better as a historian, that they...
Yes, I could.
They have... they have reasons, especially now, right? He's writing this in 1943. There are historical, cultural reasons why Europe is pretty ready to just kind of get rid of... that's good. That's bad. Oh, you think the bad is good? Well, I think as a culture, my culture should, you know, wipe your culture off the face of the planet for thinking the opposite of me. Within sort of coming out of, I mean, literally, there's a time of peace right before, relative peace right before World War I, but it's like a 70-year sort of time of relative peace right before World War I. And then from World War I, you know, through... So 1914 through 1945, you know, there's some time of peace-ish in between, but there's literally millions and millions of Europeans killed over ideas. And, you know,
But also borders. I mean, and power. I mean,
ideas, like, borders, power. I mean,
and the misuse of science.
The misuse of science.
Technology. You know,
there's a pretty good sort of motivation. I don't agree with it because I think at the end of the day, what you lose is, like Lewis says, you lose truth. But there's a pretty good motivation for saying, "Can we cool out? Like, can we stop? Can we?" And then really what the issue is really the only, right? That they sort of get rid of all things rather than even a lot of the things that are sort of leading to sort of this really polarized view on every single issue that, I mean, we live in a polarized time now, but what if our polarized time, you know, led to 50 years and millions of deaths? I mean, the reason we can kind of stay polarized is because it hasn't yet done that.
I think,
And Lewis experienced that for himself. You know, we did a little bit of a bio on Lewis a while back, but you know, he's in World War I. He lost one of his best friends. Was it Patty Moore? I think was his name.
Yeah.
And I think wasn't his platoon or squad or whatever he was. Maybe this was Tolkien. All of them, but him remained, or something along those lines.
I don't think that was.
Is that maybe Lewis? Tolkien then?
That might be Tolkien.
Okay. Well, his best friend. So, I mean, they literally all knew. Yeah, you know, I don't think you're arbitrarily using that as an interpretation, not that you think you are either, but Lewis makes constant reference to a phrase from, it's one of the old Roman authors, I think it's Horace, you know, Dulce et Decorum.
Right.
Which was a phrase, it talks about, it is sweet and fitting to die for your country. It's an old poem, but a World War I poet had co-opted that for his, it's sort of like one of those symbolic poems from the mood in Europe right after World War I, where people thought before World War I it was sweet and fitting, it was noble to die for your country. After World War I, the author that revised or newer version of the poem says, that lie has been put to death. And Lewis, he's living in the aftermath of that. He's right. And he also, I mean, especially in chapter two, but he picks up on it a bit in chapter one. He says, if everything is just reduced to materialism, there's no reason to do take any sort of moral or other sort of action apart from what your instinct tells you to do. You're kind of reduced to what does he call him? Trousered ape or an urban blockhead or whatever.
Urban blockhead. That's one I'm trying to trousered ape. I mean, and I think at the end of the day, you know, you can kind of, there's a way to piggyback this with the first Mere Christianity lecture where, you know, they're right in World War II and they really are still kind of having to make arguments for why are we doing this? You know, and at the end of the day, he's making the argument that part of the reason you would put yourself and your friends and your fellow countrymen to the point of going to war again is because there really is a right and wrong. And right is really worth standing up for, and wrong is really worth fighting.
Yeah. Whereas I think, I mean, the shift that is certainly, I think, now taking root, and we can see sort of the predictions come to hand, and I think the Green Book is a lot about this as well, is that if you let go of possessiveness over all of this, if you could not possess a country and have those kinds of emotions and insert meaning there, if you could not possess religious ideals, if you could not, and you could sort of live to the point where everybody's possessions or opinions or emotions carry the same level of value, so you and the country that you're at war with are just as valuable, and you shouldn't possess England as much as they shouldn't possess Germany.
Right.
Then the world could be at peace, and we could be a world community. We could be a society, and not possessive pockets of meaningless radicals. You know.
Yeah.
And he's making, at the end of the day, I mean, I think one of the reasons that The Abolition of Man is one of the works of Lewis that is very frequently commented on and commentaries written on is that it goes so beyond just a treatise on whether or not this book of this book of grammar should be used in the schools of his time, that it actually becomes a philosophical treatise in a lot of ways. It's not an expressly Christian, I think we should clear up for people, it's not an expressly Christian work. He doesn't call the good God or Christ. He calls it the Tao. And like Adam said, there's reasons for that. I think part of the reason is because it's powerful that it's a foreign word for him to use rather than what people would be expecting at this point. But just that at the end of the day, the familiarity, those who are familiar with the idea of the Tao, it means the good, right? That we sometimes say in the circles I used to be in that you're in, the good, the true, the beautiful, right? It sort of has that sort of connotation to it. But at the end of the day, what he's fighting for here, and he says it pages 18 and 19, I think, is... but what is common to something that we cannot neglect? It is the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others are really false to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of thing we are. Those who know the Tao, the good, can hold that to call children delightful or old men venerable is not simply to record a psychological fact about our own parental and filial emotions at the moment, but to recognize a quality which demands a certain response from us, whether we make it or not. And I think one of the big arguments that he's making is that when you lose, I mean, Paulson said this in Outlaw God on the episode about making assertions. When you lose the ability to make assertions, you also lose the ability to have people respond to assertions and with anything other than their sort of emotional response, right? If my assertion is just an emotional expression of what I'm feeling psychologically in the moment, then your response to that assertion can be the same. And now we're all just talking about ourselves.
Yeah. I think that's the big thing.
And then the question is, what becomes true in that particular context? And the answer would be, and he doesn't drop Nietzsche's name in chapter one, if I recall. It appears in chapter two, but the answer is whoever wields the most power.
Yeah.
Whoever they are the ones who determine what's good, true, and beautiful.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think you're right, Scott. This is not just about going after the green book. In fact, I keep referring to chapter two. I apologize because we're going to talk about chapter two next episode. But the very end of chapter two, he says, it's very clear all along, and the way I describe it, and correct me if you think I'm overcalling it, but I think Lewis is writing as a custodian of Western civilization, but not as sort of like a Westocentrist, if you will. But he's writing to kind of, was it Russell Kirk or whoever was behind? Oh gosh, why can't William F. Buckley would say concerning what a conservative really is. It's somebody who stands athwart history or aside from what's going on and yells, slow down or stop.
Yeah, stop.
You don't know where this is going. It's not going to end well.
And very Chestertonian, too, in that same sure, sort of way. Yeah, yeah. Sort of.
And, but end of chapter two, he says, if this the philosophy in the Green Book, the larger philosophy that looms behind the Green Book, takes hold, this is what must ensue. That is, civilization will, which is a thin veneer anyway, it will fall apart.
And I think that's a very good point, because I think people like Lewis, who are sort of, in a way, making a defense for liberalism, right, in the classical sense, not sort of the modern political sense. In other words, I always remember Scott Ashman at CUI sort of doing his, or C.J. Armstrong, one of those, doing sort of their argument for a liberal education having to do with freedom and liberty. But in order for that sort of freedom and liberty to play itself out, a person had to be educated. And to be educated sort of was to know many of the things from the past, classical literature, events that have happened, you know, learning from history. And the reason for all that is because the civilization that we enjoy really is a thin veneer. Mm-hmm. Right? We take it for granted now because it's lasted, you know, quote unquote lasted. Now we maybe ought not take it for granted. And maybe Lewis was taking it a little bit less for granted, having now lived through a Second World War, but we certainly, you know, fast forward now, 70 some odd, 80 some odd years on this, and we certainly take it for granted. And his argument that if you go down this path is essentially that you're going to lose things that you don't even realize you're going to lose here. And this will be not just a broader sort of loss of society, but in an individual sense. You're not just going to lose education, but in losing real education, you're going to lose real political discourse. And losing real political discourse, you're going to lose real liberties. And losing real liberties, you're going to lose real sort of guarantees on your own personal safety, and on and on and on and on. It's going to start broad, and it'll get real specific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting to me because, was it you, Dad? You talked about, or was it Adam? I forget, as you guys were going, that it becomes all everything. Like, the reduction that happens is that everything becomes about me. And then the only way that truth is determined, not really the way I feel, but if my party, if my people, the people who think similarly by chance,
well, I think it,
are
it,
in power.
Yeah.
And the
by chance, I think, is very important.
It is by chance, right? There's not a lot of controlling those things. And the individualism is where I think the vocation part can come in for us as this transition, which is that part of this is having a society in which the best thing you can do is avoid the needs or the calls of other people. And thus your problems are all about you or all about the society, everybody right. else.
Yeah.
By everybody else, that means extension, you are the only not problem. And the only way you have time to do this is when nobody else is calling on you. So, you know, for the Christian, one of the things is that we are set. The doctrine of vocation is essentially because you are set free by the gospel, you no longer really have to worry about you. You are now free from doing the law for your sake to get you anywhere.
For the sake of your salvation.
For the sake of your salvation. And so now that you're free, when other people call, you actually have the time to answer. And the thing is this society, or the thing that the Green Book is trying to do, is trying to take away as much of your time for to answer other people and spend all that time self-reflecting, growing, being you, formulating these opinions, formulating these emotions. I'm trying to think of literally everything everybody in my generation, even people I love and respect, well, say all the time.
There's
right?
two parts of it, isn't it? There's the crass materialism that Adam spoke about in the beginning, and there's sort of like the crass psychologicalism of it too. Mm-hmm. That
why don't you have kids? Because I haven't had enough time for me yet.
Yeah, there's a, and yet
I
mean,
I'm kind of sympathetic to that.
Adam's like, I need some me time.
He says now, as her kids are like older and older and older. Yeah. One day, Adam, one day you'll be sitting there looking at Rachel and you'll be like,
this is too much me time.
Yeah, there's too much me. There's too much us time.
I hope. I don't know. Rachel's got plans, I think.
Oh, no.
I'll be raising a 2-year-old when I'm 65, I think.
Oh, golly. Yeah, maybe you'll call that 2-year-old grandchild. No, you won't be raising
it. I hope.
You'll be visiting it.
I hope.
Yeah. At any rate, I think that... you know, as we kind of close this first chapter out, it's good to look at where we've actually ended up. I think one of the things you said is sort of by chance who's in power, because the biggest question that Lewis leaves this one on is if it's very much summarizing on my part, if you give up all sort of claims on this is good, this is bad, all sort of truth claims, right? And you leave this all, these are all just personal assertions of my current psychological experience. The real question will be, who's going to adjudicate truth? Who's going to adjudicate right and wrong? And the answer is the person in power. Now, what we've seen, I'm not trying to get political and I'm not going to get political on either side, but we've seen in our sort of modern political age that these sort of in power positions that reflect my psychological experience as it stands now, they switch very wildly, very quickly. I mean, I'm not sure that you could get a more polarized sort of national political experience between Trump and Biden, right? You might not be able to get a more polarized state to state experience between sort of California and Montana. I don't know. And these are sort of reflections of the fact that even if you're a conservative, right, when we've given up actual claims on truth, it's just the people that are in power that are able to sort of dictate right and wrong and sort of tell us what the current existential crisis of the moment is that we all need to be afraid of, which does make us look, like you said, Caleb, sort of more nationally and less at our neighbor. I was this past weekend teaching on Romans 15, and I said this is where Paul shows his Lutheran, really where Paul shows his Lutheran roots, because the whole thing is sort of an argument to sort of slow down and see the person standing across from you. And I mean, the whole first part of that chapter is like, slow down,
because
there's a person standing across from you, and that person could be weaker than you. That person could need your help. That person maybe doesn't understand the gospel as well as you do, and you're going to railroad ride over them if you just keep going.
Emotions might even have, I mean, we don't want to say that people's emotional responses or emotional meaning or descriptive meaning on things is always unimportant. But apart from it being somebody appealing to you personally with those, they are unimportant. It is unimportant to me how somebody five states over feels about what's happening in their city, as compared to it is important to me how my 4-year-old feels about, you know, doing school with his mother today, right? Like those are like two different emotional responses to things going on. One very important to me because of the vocational realm and my calling to both his mom as my wife and he as my son. And one where I have nothing to do with whatever's happening at this city in this state at this period of time. And I'm supposed to give like equal attention to everything. I am supposed to have let go of my attachments to my children and care about the society and the way people are being treated and the way people who are different than me are represented as much.
Yeah.
Because you're part of the collective. You're not a
because
part
I'm a part of the society.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, just to end this section, towards the end of this first lecture, Lewis makes the distinction between the head and the belly, right? The head is sort of where the rational things are worked out. The belly is where the emotions are. And he's saying that in the middle, somewhere in the middle, which would be your chest, is where these two things sort of work themselves out, right? The sort of draw between your head and your belly works itself out in your chest. But that chest is something that has to be trained. Mm. It has to be trained to sort of adjudicate right and wrong. And am I just looking... And when I say that's a beautiful waterfall, is that really just an expression of an emotion I'm having in the moment? Or am I able to, between my head and my belly in my chest, sort of adjudicate whether that is, you know, one of the most, if not the most beautiful thing there is, and to actually make a statement about that.
Or even to make an action. So maybe you go see something like you brought up the Grand Canyon and you sit there and you go, this is beautiful. Maybe that beauty actually has enough meaning that you go, hey, Adam, I want to take you to the Grand Canyon. Or you want to take your grandkids to the Grand Canyon. And now the meaning is that you are actually doing something with another human being.
Yeah.
It's not just that the object elicits this emotion of beauty.
Which, by the way, the Grand Canyon is a great example because until I saw the Grand Canyon, I'm like,
it's just a hole in the ground.
Worked up about? It's just a hole in the ground. And then you see it, like, then you're like, boom.
Just don't invite. Caleb said, hey, that you might invite me to the Grand Canyon. I'd find that creepy if you said, hey, Adam, you want to go on a trip to the Grand Canyon?
Let's go stand on the edge of this giant cliff. No reason.
Yeah.
I just want you to call it sublime.
Hey, do we need to, or should we, Caleb, you should answer this, talk a bit more about the Tao, because that's where he introduces the concept of the Tao in one. But yeah, chapter two is his defense of the Tao.
Yeah, titled sort of the way in reference to the Tao. So I think we could handle all that as the main material of chapter two. Chapter one, he really is setting up the problem of the language.
Correct.
So yes. I think we covered that.
And the
that.
Distinction between the head, belly, and men with chest versus... So the people that do have that trained so that in their chest you can sort of work this tension out are men with chest. What he's worried that the Green Book will produce is men without chests.
Yeah.
Without the ability to do that.
Do you think men without chest is a metaphor for men without virtue? The virtue of wisdom and courage?
I do. The thing we totally avoided here is... how specifically this chapter and then, the whole thing, but is sort of used within the sort of current age of virtue ethics, philosophy.
Maybe we'll have to tack on an episode to cover that. Yeah. I don't know. We only have so much space.
It's really not something, I mean, I've done some, like I've read some Mylander and whatnot, but it's really not something when I talk about virtue ethics, it's always under the guise of sort of my postulation about what I think it means and what I think it's getting at rather than from a position of knowing a lot about it.
I would say perhaps one of the problems is that it is all like sort of the men without chests. It is also focused far out in a lot of cases on the universal. And I think sometimes tries to co-opt things like natural law into more than what natural law is actually able to do.
I think that's an accurate criticism. The other thing it's always struck me about it is it's an attempt at objectivity through the lens of subjectivity. Mm. And
it's like saying the natural law doesn't need an interpreter. It is...
Right. So you might say somebody, you can look at somebody and say, the virtuous person is the person that lives to 10 commandments, right? That's fairly objective. What's subjective is measuring what it means to live the 10 commandments. But the 10 commandments themselves are fairly objective. You know, honor your father and mother, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't lie, don't steal. It's all fairly objective things. Within the realm of virtue ethics, sort of the most basic way I've heard it explained is that the Tao, right, the way, the virtuous thing, is to kind of just not be a jerk. And I'm like, okay, that's a little less defined.
Or not cause harm, I guess would be the more formal way to say that.
Yeah. And you think, well, that's a, what if am I not, there's a lot of what ifs there. I'll leave it at that. But there's a lot of possible what ifs to that.
I think, again, that there's some more subjectivity to it than is perhaps assumed, because sometimes there might be benefit in causing harm.
Right.
Because
that was going to be my point. That was my what if.
You know, that I like to think of certain things that sort of go outside the basics of murder, like keeping promises. This is a matter of ethics. Sometimes it would be extremely advantageous for you and for the survival of yourself and your kids, or maybe even your society, to lie, to make a promise, benefit from the making of that promise, and then not uphold it. And that the damage done to you might only be in something that we call reputation, which is subjective or limited or time locked to people's memories. And it is, you know, there isn't an abundance of natural reasons to keep all of your promises.
Now, before we get like 10 emails saying we don't know anything about virtue ethics, just remember I did
say I don't know anything about virtue
ethics by saying I don't know as much as I probably should about virtue ethics.
No.
And I'm just sitting here quietly. I'm not going to say anything about virtue ethics. I'm kind of with you, Scott. I'd be asking just what is it? Some people have suggested, like scholars on Lewis, that in many ways Lewis is like, is it Alistair MacIntyre, his book After Virtue, which is sort of like the book on virtue ethics. Lewis sort of does that before MacIntyre.
Yeah.
But it fits within that whole genre.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, let us go on to episode 2. Thank you for joining us for this first episode on the abolition of man. It is definitely different than doing Chronicles of Narnia or something more theological.
Shows the depth of Lewis, doesn't it?
It does. And if you read it, which I really highly encourage you to go beyond our sort of mumblings about it here and read it yourself, you'll find...
Scholarly commentary, you mean?
Scholarly commentary. it is captivating. It's not like he's... he's way better at fiction. He should have stayed with Narnia. He's not very good at doing this. No, this is a very captivating lecture. So.
All right.
All right. We will catch you next time. Bye.